welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is off today. But you got me in the studio, Becky Friedman, and with me are Dave and Justin. How are you guys doing?
Mushy, mushy.
I'm doing very well.
So I want to, in the midst of our wonderful blossoming spring weather, where it's finally warm enough to wear shorts and dresses and go outside and have fun in the sun.
Get sunburned.
I want to give a congrats and a shout out to someone who is not experiencing the wonderful Northern Hemisphere spring. Robert Ray, who's been on Ask an Atheist. He's of the Original Motto Project and Secular Yakking Podcast. He has started Sparky on Ice, the coldest podcast on the internet, while he's deployed at McMurdo Station in Antarctica.
Hey, congratulations, Ray. Rob.
Very well, congratulations.
I would like to know if we can actually get some numbers on that coldest podcast on the internet. I feel like that's an empirical statement that we can get data to uphold or debunk.
I would just want to know if he, you know, wanted to make it the coolest podcast on the internet, but just didn't feel that he was cool enough. And so you get the coldest. I mean, sometimes, you know, we get these crazy readings, like it's colder in, you know, the Texas Panhandle today than it is in Newfoundland, right? With strange weather patterns that are happening, with atypical weather patterns that are happening. But I'm fairly certain right now that at McMurdo Station, it is not a nice balmy 15 degrees Fahrenheit. I think that as they head into their winter, I'm betting that, empirical evidence or not, a McMurdo Station podcast is the coldest one on the internet.
I do remember my dad telling me a story about he was doing a project in North Dakota and they got hit with a snowstorm. It was already winter, so it was cold enough, but it was spent a week at negative 40 to negative 50. And he says,
are we talking what, Kelvin or
Fahrenheit? Yeah, I don't care what scale you're on. When you hit that low, it's bad. But yeah, actually, I think somewhere in the negative 40s is where it doesn't matter if it's Kelvin or Celsius or Fahrenheit, because it's the same thing.
I think there's some empirical mathematics that we could do there on that one.
But he told me, he's like, actually, it's amazing how you will get accustomed to it. And once the cold snap moved on and it was only 15 below, he says it felt warm.
Like, oh, goodness. All relative. So yeah, let's stick to the
adaptable.
let's stick to the Southern Hemisphere for a moment, because, you know, in New Zealand, we've been hearing some really difficult news over the past month. But there is something that I think went overlooked and is of great importance for those of us that really enjoy secular government and, you know, governments that allow the pluralistic, coexistence of many people. Because earlier in March, New Zealand officially struck its outdated anti-blasphemy statute from the law books after passing the bill through Parliament and receiving royal assent. Section 123 of the Crimes Act was only used once in its entire history to prosecute publishers of a poem for blasphemous libel in 1922. Over the years, offended New Zealanders had tried in vain to apply the statute to visual artists, sculptors, filmmakers, and poets, targeting well-known works such as Monty Python's Life of Brian and episodes of South Park.
Some people have no sense of humor.
Interestingly enough, I have another story about that. I got a story for everything, don't I? I was recently reading that The Life of Brian, when it came out, was actually banned in Norway for being blasphemous, which led to an advertising campaign in Sweden saying the movie too funny for Norway.
Oh, awesome. So Sweden's poking a little fun at its Scandinavian sister country over there, saying, oh, yeah. Is there like a sort of, I don't know, humor warring thing going on, saying Norwegians are humorless and Swedes are all very funny?
I would love to know what the stereotypes of Scandinavian countries about other Scandinavian countries are. Like, that sounds like the most, like, blasé. It's like, oh, they don't like enough sugar in their coffee or something. Like.
Well, if you have experience with Scandinavian insults from one Scandinavian country to another, do write us.
Yeah, come on, Odd. We want to hear from you.
Oh, yeah. We got Odd from Norway, our listener. Yeah, you can email us questions at atheist.radio. Tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA. You can also call us at 844-SKEPTIC. We do have voicemail, and we would love to be able to play some of your voicemail. So as long as all of those Scandinavian insults are of a radio safe nature, we'd be happy to play them because we're not going to charge you with blasphemy. No, I mean, here's the thing. You have those blasphemy laws that are really outdated. And as we've discussed on the show before, one person's religious belief is another is blasphemous to another person's religious belief. So in order to say, I'm going to charge you with blasphemy, you have to charge everyone. I mean, when one holy book literally says those who don't believe in the Holy Spirit are fools, right, then you are blaspheming against people of other religious convictions that don't believe in the Holy Spirit.
Right.
There is a certain time when it could be okay to legislate morality, but blasphemy laws are not the time for that.
Well, you poked a big anthill there in terms of legislating morality. That's an interesting one there that maybe we'll...
Thou shalt not kill, don't murder, that kind of thing.
I don't want those things in my legislation when they're direct from, you know, holy books and scriptures and stuff like
sure
that.
Murder falls under just pure morality. Well, I think there are more practical reasons why that would be illegal.
Well, sure. Okay. Depends on your perspective, I suppose.
Yeah, you could go at it from a utilitarian, sort of a humanistic utilitarian perspective. Which I suppose might get into morality, but also looks at just philosophy and practicality of running groups of people, right? Of organizing societies.
Maybe legislating morality adjacent?
Perhaps, yeah. Maybe. So we do have hopping all the way back to our hemisphere and our state, someone who was not really fond of legislating anymore and has now gone... straight into the morality puddle, I guess, because the head of the Family Policy Institute of Washington has stated that individuals with no religious affiliation are mounting a new religious war on traditional believers, with our state as a primary front. Mark Malosha, who was also a longtime state senator, charged that secular individuals have conquered and radicalized the Democratic Party, news media, Hollywood, government, and academia, and have declared war on faithful Christians, Orthodox Jews, and Muslims. Malosha, a Catholic, initially entered the legislature as a Democrat, but switched to the Republican Party during his last 4 years in office. He used a sexual health education bill making its way through the state legislature to illustrate how, in his estimation, the non-religious will reverse the progress of 3,000 years of Western Judeo-Christian culture and civilization.
See, it's the weirdest thing. I was over here thinking that we were trying to get people of all races and genders and sexes and creeds to just kind of get along a little bit better. I didn't realize it was a declaration of war.
Oh, yeah. A religious war at that.
Religious war.
Would you ever think that someone who is not religious wants to... invoke a religious war? I think you're getting us mixed up with that legislature from the east side, Matt Shea, and by east side I mean Eastern Washington, who right. literally has a sermon that he's given on the basis for biblical war. If you want to talk about religious wars, talk about that guy, not about the person that says, hey, we should have secularism as the thing that governs our people so that all people are allowed to practice their particular religions.
Maybe be nice.
I don't even see it's funny because you're objecting on the term religious. My objection is on the term war. Do you know what a war actually is?
Oh, like, good call.
It's one of those things, like, the hyperbole is starting to get to me, how everything is a war. There's a war on women. There's a war on terror. There's a war on drugs. There's a war on this. There's a war
on Christmas.
That. War on Christmas. Oh, my God. The most absurd war. Where is Jim Generalissimo Mulvian, the war of Christmas?
Never forget Bowling Green.
Right. But, like, how about we stop using the term war for anybody who disagrees with us? Like,
Well, you would not fire up your ultra-conservative believers who really want this Family Policy Institute kind of crap that's, you know, pervading this kind. When you say a religious war, it lights a spark under people and enables them to come to your side. That's another way of organizing societies, right?
Right.
It's the Donnybrook on Christmas.
And that's the thing, scrap on drugs. It's a semantic trick that... I won't even say both sides, because I would say there are multiple sides, more than two, that use this trick. Like, anytime anybody wants to get someone fired up about or for action for something, they're going to start calling it a war on something. And it's like, it's a semantic trick that's so played out and so tired. It's like, hey, can we actually have a discussion rather than just like paint the other guy as the enemy of everything good?
Weaponized rhetoric.
All right. Well, permit me to, for a moment, weaponize my rhetoric against Mark Malosha, because here... In his estimation, you know, we personally, those of us who have no religious affiliation, are about to launch war on everything. And Washington is our home base. I don't know. Nobody gave me the memo. Washington's our home base. Are we mustering troops? Am I supposed to be somewhere right now?
I think we're all AWOL. Does that mean I have to get my guest bed ready?
Oh, like, man. Are we like the Quartering Act doesn't apply anymore? So, you know, Malosha was one of just a few Democrats, and I'll say Democrat in quotes. He was a Democrat in name. He voted against marriage equality back in 2012 when we thought that it was perhaps a good thing, maybe, for the legislature to vote on things like civil rights. Now, this is way before Obergefell v. Hodges legalized marriage equality across the nation through the Supreme Court case. But besides that, you know, I mean, he switched to the Republican Party. I think that the Democrats were fine to be done with him, but that doesn't mean that secularists have radicalized the Democratic Party. You have folks like Cory Booker, who's a contender, and he has religious references all the time to things. You know, speaking of hyperbole, Dave, all right, so we got this sex ed bill going through the legislature. You know, maybe it will be mandatory that kids in Washington state will be able to learn about their bodies, learn about consent, to be able to protect themselves and advocate for themselves and others, and maybe stay healthy and figure out how to be responsible adults engaging in relationships. Yeah, he says that will will legalize child prostitution, child pornography, and infanticide.
Not to get flippant here, but a Catholic is complaining about child pornography, child prostitution, like...
Your whole church has been...
Will you look at thine own house first? There's planks and eyes and various glass house things that we need to talk about here. Right, this is a bill about, like, educating people, about teaching people stuff. This is the same absurdity that you had with a couple of years ago. There was some people who were pushing back against giving teenage girls the HPV vaccine because they said, well, if you give her this, then she will just go out and sleep with anyone. It's like, that's not how things work. You don't, you know, teaching kids how their bodies work does not mean pornography or prostitution. Like, are you kidding me? It's absurd.
It's absurd, but it's another thing in his bag of hyperbolic rhetoric. Just like the religious war thing, he's going to start associating an educational bill with horrible, horrible acts, be they illegal or immoral, in order to fire up some kind of base that he clearly lost when he's no longer an elected official.
Right.
There's some really other fun things. So I want to give a shout out to all the trans folks and gender nonconforming folks. Today is Trans Visibility Day. Mark Malosha actually alleges that using gendered pronouns, like saying men or women, is going to become a hate crime in Washington. Right? Because that's what trans folks want, right? Just to make it so that nobody has... any kind of right to be part of the gender binary. No, that's not at all what we're looking at here. Just because someone wants to use a gender neutral pronoun or use one that you don't think should be assigned to them doesn't mean that, Mark Malosha, you're going to have your mister taken away or you won't be able to be called a man.
This guy should be ranting on the side of a street with a cardboard sign, not in a position of power.
Am I giving them too much airtime now?
Oh, I don't know, but this guy is a goober.
I just throw this idea out there. Okay, so here's a fun little fact about me. My name's not actually David or Dave. It's David.
What?
My birth name is David.
My name's not Becky. It's Rebecca.
Right, and I don't really particularly like the name David. I prefer Dave. So most people who know me and respect me call me Dave. It works the same way. If I have a friend who I knew as she for years, and she comes to me and says, I'm not real comfortable with gender pronouns, I prefer they, then they are they, because they're my friend and I respect them. That's the end of it.
You know, there's a big difference between what I think this guy maybe perceives as being some sort of like discrimination or intolerance towards him. But it's not, if you just slip up and you forget someone's name or someone's gender pronoun, that's not going to be a problem.
That's not going to be hate crime.
It's not going to be hate crime. It's just, if you keep doing it, if you aggressively keep doing it, at that point you become the problem.
Yeah. You say, I'm really sorry. I'm working on it.
Yeah. Sorry. Hey, apologize. My bad.
So Mark Melosha also wants Christians, Muslims, and Orthodox Jews to unite to defend supposed common values against nuns, and nuns meaning not the ones wearing habits, you know, of his own religion. I mean, the N-O-N-E. We have none, no particular religious affiliation.
Fear the void.
But here's the thing. I mean, what are the common values that unite, that could possibly unite Christians, Muslims, and Orthodox Jews, when this guy ends his essay by saying, let us make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that Jesus has commanded? Yeah, I'm sure your Orthodox Jewish friends and your Muslim friends are really going to get in line with you, Mark Melosha.
That sounds like a declaration of war.
You know what? Yeah. Well, I mean, baptizing them, and then, I mean, that might be,
that's what it sounds
extraordinary
like
to rendition techniques to baptize someone. So, here's the thing. Washington State is one of the least affiliated religious states. It doesn't mean that just because there are fewer people going to church on a regular basis and fewer people associating with belief in supernatural and belief in a traditionally described God or deity, doesn't mean that we're going to war against you. We just want to do our thing and live our lives. This is Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break. And I think we'll be getting into the meat of some political things that happened this week.
Don't have much time. Hurry.
Is this thing on?
Yeah. Good.
We just escaped the salesmen.
The squid ink salesmen. They keep us captive.
For those useless ink products.
I think they're close. I know we wouldn't make it far.
Please don't buy the products. We don't know what they do.
They might have side effects. They're here!
For more information, please go to imnotsquidding.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam's off today. I'm Becky, in for Sam, with Dave and Justin in the studio. And we have been itching all week, or all, I guess, 2 weeks, to dig into this.
Itchy and scratchy.
Mueller. It's Mueller time, isn't it, Justin?
It is Mueller time.
All right. So, Dave, Justin, you guys are a little bit more politically literate in this particular thing because of the media consumption that you've done and the research that you kind of do. Certainly more than I. I'm more like locally focused, what bills are going through the legislature.
Is this an intervention?
No. Not an intervention at all, unless it's an intervention for me. Because I know that there was this report. It was like 400 pages. I'm expecting at some point there to be a book published and bound, like the Star Report. We've got one of those hanging around. But all that came out was some particular letter that may or may not have been a summary from a guy that was hired by the president who said that Mueller is a bunch of baloney anyway. So please help me make sense of the Mueller report and what we know about it.
All right.
The first thing you got to start off with is like, what what the Mueller report itself was, what the entire investigation was.
It was the thing that was going to get President Trump impeached, right, and thrown in jail.
Not quite. Oh, not quite. Okay. There's a difference between a counterintelligence investigation and a criminal investigation. A counterintelligence investigation, what you're searching for there is the who, what, when, where, why, and how of the situation. Criminal investigation is you take that information and then you apply the laws to it and see if there's a violation of statutes.
So which one was this then?
A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. It is a investigation of what happened, what went down in the run-up to the 2016 election. And actually, that's an important point. It's the remit is the scope of the investigation. And that was about the Trump campaign investigating those ties between the campaign itself and the Russian government, right?
Okay.
So you can't have the Trump campaign after Trump already wins the election and assumes the presidency. So there's a certain end point of things that he stops investigating. He's getting the lead up there. As far as the actual alleged behaviors, they're a little bit different. We'll go into like what Barr had characterized the investigation as later on. But the actual alleged behaviors weren't necessarily things that they were statements of character, association, compromise, information about business dealings, Trump Tower Moscow, any financial entanglements with this guy's been real estate for how many decades now? 40 years, 30 years, 40 years, something like that. He's got a long history. And what you're trying to find if you're doing a counterintelligence / criminal investigation into someone like that is you're trying to find out if they've made decisions in their business life that other people know about. And if other people know about them, but they're not upfront about them, then they can use that as compromise over them to get something.
So,
extortion,
okay, all right,
blackmail, that kind of thing.
This is sounding rather mobby. I mean, what yes. kind of what we think of? And
yes. Are you implying a connection between the mob and a New York real estate developer? No.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what it came off as for me when I was watching that the Mueller is doing investigations and that there's business. It did sound like okay, this is like a mob boss movie kind of going on.
Not directly. Mapped on to the mob analogy, but you know, hey, close enough for government work.
Okay.
So, you get the point. We've all seen the movies. We're familiar with what an implied threat is. We maybe don't think about it in the terms of a counterintelligence investigation or in terms of blackmail, but everybody's got something in their past that somebody knows about that you'd be embarrassed about going forward. And if you're put into a position of extreme power, like, say, the presidency, you have levers of all branches of the American government and armed forces that you can use. And if you're in a compromised position to a certain person, you might do some things that benefit them. And that was what was actually being investigated.
Okay.
As far as whether all of that information, the entirety of the counterintelligence information actually is in the report, because we haven't seen the report yet, important to note, that'll be up to levels of classification and certain types of redaction, that kind of thing. as far as Trump maybe being arrested over it, I mean, there's DOJ policy that says that you can't indict a president anyway, so that wasn't likely going to happen.
And there's potentially constitutionally that you can't indict a sitting president.
Potentially.
Well, isn't that why we have an impeachment process where Congress can essentially, like, in their own congressional way, quote unquote, arrest someone or bring someone to trial through an impeachment trial rather than a criminal trial?
Right. Yeah. Impeachment happens in the House. That's how it's decided by them. And then that's like the indictment process, if we're going to map it onto the criminal field. And then the trial would happen in the Senate.
Okay.
So that would be like the judge, jury, that kind of thing.
And the whole point of this is that we don't want we want political solutions to political issues, that we don't want people using the DOJ as an arm for handling political situations. So the laws were originally written up so that it's like, no, you can't indict somebody on this. Like, the classic case in like they teach in law school, which I have not been to law school, to be clear. But if a senator is driving to the Senate to vote on a bill and they hit somebody with their car and kill them, they cannot be prosecuted for that because they are in the process of performing their actions of the government, and the Constitution forbids them from being prosecuted for actions they take as part of their government responsibilities.
Wow, that's really interesting. But yeah. if they had vehicular homicide in a different circumstance on a Saturday night, right, for instance,
then they can be prosecuted for that.
Okay.
Right. Or the voters could remove that senator by a recall or whatever other metric there is. So when you think about it in that way, the counterintelligence aspect plays a bigger role, more so than the prosecutorial criminal aspect. The thing that we have to understand with that, as Dave said, we don't want to weaponize the Department of Justice. You don't want to weaponize the law against someone, especially if it's not something that rises to the clear and obvious level of being able to convict in a court.
Well, Trump has been saying through all of his proclamations that the investigation into his campaign is a witch hunt. He's kind of been suggesting that very thing, that a Department of Justice investigation is being used against him, like criminally, in a way that's just political gripes.
He wants to make that case. The problem is that we all have eyes.
We have
seen what he's been, what kind of things he's been up to. And solution, I would think, to the end of an investigation like this would be something that would be handled by Congress. Unless, and of course, if Mueller had found clear and convincing and compelling evidence that like a videotape of, say, Trump himself with a Russian government official saying, some snidely whiplash kind of thing.
Some sort of smocking gun.
Smocking gun. But if we don't have that, that doesn't mean there's nothing. They're also trying to operate this as if it's a binary. There is either exactly a complete convictable evidence or zero evidence. It exists on a spectrum.
This is a very, very interesting trick and something to notice that, like, you'll see a lot of people in conservative circles now basically saying, look, unless you have, you know, it's all circumstantial evidence. It's all, you know, none of it counts. It's all, there's no direct evidence. It's all circumstantial. And they'll use that term a lot, circumstantial evidence. Well, circumstantial evidence is anything except eyewitness report. Like, everything else is circumstantial. For example, a smoking gun is circumstantial because you're not actually seeing the gun fire or having someone who saw a gun fired reporting it. You're seeing a gun with smoke coming out of it. That happened after the fact.
It's the thing that we can draw reasonable inferences about,
right?
Yeah.
Even though it's not a fact that verifies a particular charge.
All physical evidence, all forensic evidence is circumstantial. So you can build a case on that.
Mm. So I'm kind of thinking and seeing a parallel here between, since we're, you know, rationally minded, we aspire to be rationally minded, we like the scientific method, sort of that difference between saying, I had a hypothesis, the evidence didn't support my hypothesis, it was inconclusive, but it doesn't mean in that case, when you run an experiment and your evidence doesn't support your hypothesis, doesn't inherently mean that that your hypothesis has been falsified, right? Like, there's a difference between falsifying a hypothesis and just not having evidence to support it.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it seems like from all of the reports about Mueller's report that there's just not enough evidence that rises to the level that would be required to show a smocking gun, so to speak. But Trump keeps saying that the report exonerates him.
No, absolutely not. There's another aspect of this as well, as far as jurisdiction and authority. The layout for what the special counsel's office is allowed to do as far as their authority goes, because you would want to have the national security apparatus of the United States behind an investigation like that, so you actually have the resources to get the answers that you're looking for. However, the special counsel's office is limited in what it can investigate just at a practical level. Whereas the implied powers of Congress laid out in Article 1, Section 8 is due to the necessary and proper clause. That's what gives Congress the power of oversight and acts as a check and balance against the executive branch, a part of which the special counsel's office is.
I really want to apply. I don't know what the particular clause is, but I really want to apply the words necessary and proper to anything Trump does. Like, is it necessary and is it proper? No, then shut up.
Trump has never done anything proper in his life.
And all of it has been unnecessary.
That's okay. That might be a slight overstatement. I'm just kidding.
But back to the report.
What Mueller could even do with this report is give it to Congress so that they can continue the investigation with their powers, because, you know, checks and balances, they are a separate and co-equal branch. Or if he finds direct, clear, convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt evidence that someone did commit a crime, then he can bring that prosecution. So it stays on both sides of that fence.
Now, hasn't Mueller farmed out a lot of evidence or a lot of information and possible prosecutions to like the LA County prosecutor and several in New York and things like that?
Absolutely. What Mueller was supposed to be investigating was, and this is very specific language, the Trump campaign and connections and ties with the Russian government in the furtherance of their election meddling or election interference activities.
Okay.
So Trump campaign, if you have a cutout from the campaign, a Roger Stone type, a friend, a close buddy, or the Russian government, if you're ex-Russian government, if you're ex-KGB, you're no longer a part of the Russian government. Technically speaking, since 1993, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, isn't technically a part of the Russian government.
Weird.
Yeah.
All sorts of so if you have someone like Jared Kushner, who is very much involved in the Trump organization,
very much involved,
Jared
Kushner acts as an advisor to the president.
Okay.
Let's say Donald Trump Jr. isn't necessarily exactly a part of the campaign or of the administration. So there's very legally specific language that is being used here.
Got it. Okay.
I call it weaponized pedantry.
I like that. I think I'm guilty of that occasionally in my role as a teacher. but we have the Mueller report, but then we have what some people are calling a summary by the Attorney General William Barr.
Mm-hmm.
And William Barr even said, hey, media is saying that I gave a summary, but that's even, you know, wrong. It seemed like he was singing the same party line as Trump by saying, like, oh, media is mischaracterizing everything. Media is against me. Media is against us. And he said, it's not a summary of the Mueller report. It's a summary of the primary conclusions. Na, 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 boo, boo. If anything were to be weaponized pedantry.
Don't call it a summary. Call it a comeback. Barhead. Thank you, Dave. Barr had two separate and distinct letters that he had written to Congress. The thing to understand about this is there is going to be some information from the actual Mueller report that is going to be reasonably, justifiably, per regulation and statute, not available to the general public.
That's the redaction.
Redactions,
the
classified information, sources and methods information. We don't want our geopolitical adversaries having access to how we know what we know. They might be able to find out that we know what we know, but if they find out how we got to there, then they're not going to do it that way anymore.
Okay.
And they'll change their methods, and then it's a back and forth. So the Barr letter has several aspects of it that make it literally true. It shows that the Trump campaign, again, specific language, did not literally conspire with the Russian government in the election meddling attempts.
So is this where Trump gets off saying, I'm completely exonerated?
Well, the thing that's important to note about that is that both Trump and his followers, even if it didn't say that, they'd be saying that anyway.
Okay.
We had the lawyers for Manafort outside of a courthouse where the judge, Amy Berman Jackson, and the other guy, T.S. Ellis, I think there is a mix-up between this judge and an author. I'm just going to say T.S. Ellis.
It's not T.S. Eliot.
it's not T.S. Eliot. Okay. Where both of those judges explicitly said to the same lawyer for Manafort, this has nothing to do with the Russian investigation. Completely separate crimes.
Okay.
Completely separate crimes that Manafort was being charged with. And then his lawyer comes out and says, well, this just shows, once again, no evidence of, like, they don't care about reality. We have to care about reality and specificity and law and legality, but they don't have to care about that. So Trump was going to get the no collusion soundbite out there anyway, no matter what it showed. however, to be fair.
So what is the reality then?
No, the reality is that the Trump campaign and members of did not literally have the Snidely Whiplash moment of conspiring with agents of the Russian government. Like, you do this for me, I do this for you. This is the crime we're going to commit, and then commit it down to paper.
And by the way, let's do a selfie together and post Instagram. Exactly.
As a side note to that, you can't really have a conspiracy if an agreement, tacit or express, doesn't happen before the crime. The crime here being the hacking and dissemination of the emails from the DNC, DCCC, and John Podesta. That's accessory after the fact, is what we're talking
about.
Okay,
so that's two different things.
That's two separate
conspiracy is when you conspire to do something, and then you do it.
Becky, Dave, let's go rob the bank at this location at this time. Take a selfie, post it on Instagram. That's conspiracy.
Okay.
If you rob a bank and then afterwards you give me some of the money and I help you cover it up, that would be the kind of thing that's accessory after the fact.
Okay. Just full disclosure, none of us in this room are going to rob a bank. No, I was going to say none of us are robbing a bank.
Oh.
That too. We're not lawyers, and we're not robbing a bank.
So there's that aspect too. That is the thing that literally did not happen. However, and this is important, and everybody should pay attention to this, even Barr said that the Russian government did, in fact, interfere with our election in 2016.
Okay.
Can we just get that out there, please? Because that's also something that Trump has been denying and the administration has been denying happened the whole time.
Yeah. The question of whether or not the Russians worked with Trump to interfere with the election is... It's kind of like, Becky, you were saying with the hypothesis. We haven't been able to falsify it. We haven't found the evidence to support it either. It doesn't say it didn't happen. And understand, like, when they're saying we did, or there's no collusion, this report fully exonerates the president. The letter Barr wrote specifically quotes the Mueller report as saying this does not completely exonerate the president.
That's about obstruction of justice.
Yeah. The report specifically says it does not exonerate him. So don't listen to anyone saying it completely exonerates him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another thing to pay attention to with that, as far as the conspiracy aspect of this, if you're going to be charged with conspiracy to defraud the United States of America, which would be what the name of the crime would be, that is an exceedingly high bar, and for good reason. You got to have a lot of evidence in order to prove that case. If you're going to bring the full weight of the American legal system down on a person, you better make sure that you're right. Right. So it's hard to prove that for a good reason. As far as the Russians actually did interfere aspect of that, let's just remember that when Trump stood next to Putin in Helsinki, he literally stated that, like, this is something that our intelligence agencies have been saying the whole time before the Mueller investigation started. Okay. Russia did this thing. And we've got the commander in chief saying, no, I believe Putin. He had a strong denial. I believe him. I believe Putin.
Stop. The voice just gives me chills, Justin.
he is siding with the Russian government against, on a factual basis, against American intelligence agencies. That's collusion.
Ooh, is it? Is that what collusion means?
He's sweeping the snow behind Putin's feet to help cover up the tracks in some sort of rhetorical way.
Is it collusion even if you're doing it like totally out in the open?
Yeah.
I mean, because it seems like it would be obvious to say no.
Yeah, it's not legally chargeable. It's not literally a crime.
Okay.
But it's this...
dirty and rotten.
Yeah, it's dirty and rotten. And the other thing that the first Barr letter specifically mentions is grand jury and classified redactions. This is separate and apart from the second one, which I'll get into in a minute. Nothing wrong with that, good and proper. Now, the way that this is bull is that, one, you can't indict a sitting president for Office of Legal Counsel and Department of Justice policy. He said that they couldn't prove obstruction of justice, but Barr doesn't have the authority to make that kind of distinction. Like, he kind of can just say it,
Well, isn't he the attorney? Isn't he the attorney general? Doesn't he have all of the qualifications to make that particular determination?
Qualifications is a squishy word.
Okay.
The special counsel, it was within the special counsel's authority to make a determination either way.
So and Barr is the one that doesn't have the authority?
The whole point of this goes back to you can't indict a sitting president. And the idea is like you don't want the prosecution of a person being run by the guy who hired that person. Barr is a Trump appointee. This is why this whole report would go to Congress for them to look at it for impeachment.
Should go to Congress. It hasn't gone there yet.
That's the whole point. That's the way this whole thing works. It's like you don't want the guy that President Trump appointed as attorney general to be prosecuting Donald Trump. That is, you cannot get a better example of a conflict of interest.
I think there's so much here to still unpack that we're gonna need to continue unpacking it a little bit after the break. You are listening to Ask an Atheist. You can find us at atheist.radio on Facebook, where amongst all of the Russian hackers, I suppose, at Ask an Atheist WA. We'll be back in a minute.
Hello, we are here to inform you about the dangers of squid ink. My name is Lila. I am here with Bree and Ash. Squid ink does not do anything good. It hurts people. It's dangerous. Now on to Ash to tell you what squid ink is supposed to do, but it doesn't, and what it shouldn't do that it does.
Yes, thank you, Lila. Now, squid ink side effects are very dangerous. The scar healer is supposed to get rid of the cuts. No. It causes explosive diarrhea. If hold it on for too long, you could explode. Now, on to Brianna.
Thank you, Ash. You see, squid ink can cause severe bleeding, coughing, sudden paralysis, and death. You now know this. You cannot ignore this. Now, on to Lila.
Thank you, Bree. Thank you, Ash. As you see, squid ink is not safe. It's dangerous. Listen, or you will be in danger. If you want to be rid of squid ink forever, call 1-800-SQUID-INK right now.
Yeet! Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. We were getting into the depths of the Mueller report and the Barr letters and the summaries and the not summaries and the obstructions and the collusions and the exonerations, or lack thereof. Justin, I'm still kind of confused about the two letters that Barr sent out that he said weren't a summary, but the media is calling a summary.
Okay, so a couple of the other things that Barr had said in his first letter, on a factual basis, were that, why it's squishy and weird that he did this in the first place. He doesn't mention any further steps of disclosure in the first letter. There's no
disclosure to Congress.
Disclosure to the public.
And that's the thing that a lot of America's really rooting for.
That's what we want. There's no mentions of limits of scope or investigative avenues as far as how wide and how broad this investigation was allowed to go. No mention of description of the length of the report, how many exhibits there were, even a page count kind of thing. In the first letter, didn't have that. No real justification outside of a very flimsy one for why he made the call on obstruction that he did.
And the call on obstruction was that we don't have,
that was the quote of, does not prove that he committed obstruction of justice. Also does not exonerate.
Okay.
Which is, it's weird because there's brackets around the letter T where in the part that he quotes, which means that it's the second half of a sentence, which is very interesting.
Leaves us wondering what was the first half of that sentence.
He spliced out the back end of that sentence, which is very odd.
Pure speculation, but the beginning of that sentence would have been, were it anyone but the president, we would have called for an indictment on this, but...
However. semicolon.
I'm not saying that's what's in there. That is speculation. I'm saying is that we don't know what the first half of that sentence is. There's an entire clause of a sentence
that's just not there.
Could change the entire meaning of that.
And then the second Barr letter... it mentions the length of the report, not specifically, but to a certain level. It mentions, this is very interesting, mentions further redactions than the original letter did.
So in like a 4-day period of time, something's been brought to his attention that says, oh no, we also need to black out this stuff too from the public?
Mm-hmm. He's talking about personally embarrassing information.
Embarrassing to whom? How is that national security matter?
On who? Why hide it? Who gets to decide what's relevant? What statute is he talking about? I cannot think of a single statute apart from DOJ. Like, granted, I don't work in that field, but I can't think of anything that would be like, oh, no, you're not allowed to have personally embarrassing information come out. That is a part of this investigation. Under what framework is he making these decisions?
Maybe Trump's feeling necessary and proper all of a sudden. he's going to claim propriety, and anything that would show that Trump was not proper in any context is blacked out. I'm kind of with you on this. It's kind of crazy.
Also interesting to that point is that he does say in the second letter that the White House won't review for executive privilege.
So meaning like Trump and his lawyer and his counsel won't take a look at it.
White House counsel won't take a look at it. Okay. Search for things that are protected by executive privilege.
That's good, right? Because then we know that.
That's also a factual statement.
Take it with a grain of salt.
Okay.
Yeah, because Trump himself will not be able to redact what he wants, but the guy he hired to be Attorney General will. So,
the illusion of propriety. Also, don't call it a summary. He's very sensitive about it being called a summary.
But guys, it's not a summary.
It's not a summary of the report. It's a summary of the report's primary conclusions.
you can look at the original letter yourself. You can just see the way as it is printed on a piece of paper. It looks like a summary, guy.
Of course, the letter was addressed to Lindsey Graham, so maybe winding is just the way he's trying to write into his recipient's knowledge base.
Oh, okay. Good call, Dave.
And also, the last thing that I have to say about the second letter, he states that he will testify.
That Barr will testify. Testify to what?
Congress.
That's really, but on what kinds of things? That's really intriguing.
Oh, Becky, anything and everything.
Ooh, kind of fun stuff. So this is not solved. Just because the Mueller investigation has come to an end and been wrapped up and he submitted his report does not mean that any of this is over at all.
Right. Now, once we get a hold of the actual Mueller report itself, investigative journalists will be able to kind of put together a narrative of the broad strokes of what happened. We'll get like the big picture, 30,000 foot view of what went down as far as the investigative steps and the kind of things they were following up on, and then we'll have to have Congress follow up with those investigations.
Which has no effect on the other 17 ongoing investigations and indictments and various court cases against the president and his actions. Like, Justin, you were saying at the very beginning of this, this is specifically about ties to Russia during the election. There's a whole lot of else going on there. Don't forget Stormy Daniels. That's a big one.
And Summer Zervos.
Yes.
One of the things that I've liked about participating in back and forth rhetorical conversations with people who are Trump supporters who are like rubbing my face at it and all that kind of thing. Oh, it didn't show no collusion. They're so excited. They're so happy. And I just like saying, hey, wouldn't you also like the Mueller report release? Then you can rub my face in it twice, right? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah, let's see what happens with this information when it's out there.
I just have one question for you, Justin.
I might have an answer for you.
How many push pins, how many bulletin boards, and how many pieces of red yarn did you go through in order to come to all of the conclusions and understand all of the connections that you currently have presented here today?
There's a reason I'm broke.
Well, speaking of conspiracy theorists, lawyers for conspiracy theorist Alex Jones released a video of his deposition where he claims that a form of psychosis compelled his belief that the Sandy Hook massacre that left 20 children dead was staged. The 3-hour deposition was recorded on March 14th as part of the defamation lawsuit Jones is facing from victims' family members. He also claimed that untruthful media has traumatized him to the point of distrusting everything and testified that he was now learning that a lot of times things aren't staged.
I have nothing kind to say about this man.
I wouldn't expect you to have anything kind to say about this man. I find it rather, I can't even say I find it curious, but he's reporting this thing, the media lies, and And because I think that the media lies, my own belief that the media lies has traumatized me to the point of distrusting everything. That's not the media's fault, Mr. Jones. That's your own self wrapping yourself into your own trauma.
Is my question here is your argument that this quote unquote form of psychosis is an excuse for your behavior? Because I can't see psychosis as being an excuse for any behavior. If this were true, let's like completely give him the benefit of the doubt. He lives in a world of lies and craziness, and he doesn't understand truth anymore. At what point does that exonerate him from damaging the lives of the people or of the victims of shootings?
Well, and he profited off of those things. He got more clicks. Oh, yeah. He got more views. And to say, even if, you know, this was defamation, even if it was at the hands of someone who was experiencing psychosis, you profited off of that. You profited off of extreme falsehoods and insults that were based on nothing. And we can't forget that in an earlier deposition, in a divorce proceeding, he said that all the things that made Alex Jones Alex Jones was a character. He was playing a character. Now are you saying that you were not playing a character, and that the character that you weren't playing was suffering psychosis that was media induced? I mean, this guy is trash.
I'm not necessarily of the opinion that Alex Jones should do time in jail.
Oh, this is just a defamation lawsuit. I think that any of his profits should go to these families.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, not that I was comparing you in any way, Justin, to Alex Jones. I mean,
I resemble that remark.
Yes, yes, you do. Let's come back home. Let's come back home to Washington State, because this is a perennial that keeps popping up, much like Alex Jones. Won't seem to go away. And Dave, I know that you've been on the show digging into this guy over the past 3 or 4 years or so.
Right.
Joe Kennedy, the former football coach from the Bremerton School District, has managed to reopen his wrongful termination suit in U.S. District Court. Kennedy's contract as an assistant coach was not renewed in 2016 after he refused to quit leading post-game prayers on the football field. School officials said that Kennedy's actions violated district policy and the U.S. Constitution's prohibition on establishment of religion. The U.S. Supreme Court this January rejected an appeal by Kennedy to force the district to rehire him during the course of lower court proceedings. But Justice Alito had stated that issues regarding free speech rights of public school teachers may justify review in the future. Now his case returns to district court for further adjudication at lower levels.
This, I think, is terrifying. When we first started following this story a few years ago, when this happened in 2016, like, it was more of a joke and kind of laughing, because here's the thing. The law, the precedent is very clear. They've had cases very similar to this. This is a coach who used his position of authority to make coerce kids into praying. And when he was told not to, continued. And he wasn't even fired. Like, make that clear. He was not fired. He was not rehired the next year.
You have to reapply as coach every year. That's how those positions work.
Now, unfortunately, we live in a world where the Supreme Court has gone mad. And there, if you are watching some of the things the Supreme Court does recently, the right wing of the court is actually putting in their dissents and in their releases little sort of hints like, hey, this may not be a great case, but we would love to overturn this law. Send me a better case. And this is the exact type of case.
So this is an invitation that Alito is saying to all of the Christian law defense firms that are out there.
Your Alliance Defending Freedom, your ALCJ, all these crazy groups that just, you know, try and like reinterpret the law for Christian dominionism. Like, it's absurd that they have the power in the court now. They want this case to go up. And if this case makes it to the Supreme Court, I fully believe the Supreme Court is going to overturn any precedent on school prayer.
And it is not about rights. It is about this guy being able to force kids to do what he wants them to do. Right. That's what this is about.
Much as he might protest that that's not at all the case. We see that, that we have folks that want to use the claim of religious freedom and religious rights to mean religious dominance, to mean religious coercion of others, to mean...
Right. You have the freedom to for me to practice my religion everywhere.
Exactly. And that's just not the case, Mr. Kennedy. I'm interested to see where this goes. I'm going to be looking more closely, Dave, at those little invitations in either dissents or in the little, you know, rulings, remanding things back to lower courts. I think that it's something to really watch out for.
Yep. Weaponized rhetoric.
There's a recent case where Justice Thomas actually kind of threw out a hint that he's willing to overturn Gideon versus Wainwright, which is a precedent that gives us the right to a lawyer.
Ooh, in terms of those all those Miranda rights that are read to you?
Not the rights that are read to you, but in terms of like
you have a right to
a public defender. Mm-hmm. Because previously, before Gideon versus Wainwright, right to a lawyer means they couldn't stop you from bringing a lawyer in. But Gideon versus Wainwright pointed out like there is a different justice system for people who can afford lawyers and people who can't, and that's not right. And so therefore
violates equal protection clause.
Right. It violates the equal protection clause if you don't have your own lawyer. So if you don't have one, the state has to provide one. Justice Thomas believes that's not true.
Very kind of scary things. And whether you believe that we secularists are on the war path against all religious folks, or whether you are rationally minded and understand that we have no quarrel with folks that wish to practice their religion in peace with others in a pluralistic society, I think that we should be sending some strong messages through our own actions and activities to Alito, to Thomas. You've been listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Thank you, Dave, for being here with me today.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Justin.
You're very welcome.
We'll see if we can untangle all of your yarn and pushpins and all of those connections.
I'm trying to sew a blanket.
Email us at questions@atheist.radio and find us on Twitter and Facebook. Our voicemail is 844-SKEPTIC. Thank you, Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield, for our music. We'll see you guys later. Happy spring.